Thanks for listening to Shift Your Spirits. I'm Slade Robertson. For 12 years, I've been a professional intuitive and personal development blogger. I try to talk about spirituality with fewer hearts and flowers than most New Age blather. I also mentor emerging intuitives, psychics, and healers in a program called Automatic Intuition. It is Sunday, August 19th, 2018, as I record this introduction. We're almost at the end of my summer series of fascinating interview guests. Technically, this is the last interview, and for those of you who miss my rambling solo episodes, I'll be back next week for the season finale with a big old dose of me and my reflections on one of my personal energetic conflicts as of late. But this week, I have an interview with John Shaughnessy about the true reason the ancient pyramids were built and how they work. This was a mind-blowing revelation for me when I first encountered it about a year ago. If you're at all interested in ancient Egypt, ancient astronauts' theory, Atlantis, the Mayans, the mystery of the pyramids, the mystery of the moon, John Shaughnessy's groundbreaking theory sparks the imagination while making an incredible amount of sense. And that interview is coming up in just a few minutes. As always, there's an oracle segment at the end of the show, so be thinking about a question or a concern you have. Hold it in your mind. I'll come back on after the final links and credits and leave you with that extra channeled message. In personal news, as I often say when I've got a nice big juicy long interview, I'm going to keep the personal news short. This week's update on my 50 new things before 50, I had an energy mastery healing session, which was amazing. And I also started a new writing project. It's super weird and unlike any stories I've put out there before, and it's really flowing out of me, and I'm super excited about it. If you're listening to this episode at the time of posting, then Mercury just went direct, and the layers of everything being retrograde this summer are starting to peel off one by one. You should be noticing some forward movement in your life and hopefully feeling some relief. And the next few weeks, as we finish August and go into September, are increasingly nice, I guess you could say, astrologically, certainly by comparison to what they have been. Incidentally, listen in John's interview for the alternate astronomy-based explanation for the bombardment of energy the Earth has been experiencing this summer. He talks about how the planets are all on the other side of the sun. I thought that was very interesting, and it's very timely, so listen in for that. The new Shift Your Spirits podcast discussion group has been soft launched on Facebook. The Automatic Intuition folks are moving in there and setting things up. We're smudging the place and feeding the unicorns. I'll be inviting a few Patreon supporters and super fans of the show to join the group early. So depending on when you're listening to this, if you're dying to get in there and meet everyone who is connected through this podcast, let me know. I'm currently standing at the velvet rope, keeping it VIP. Before I forget, I do want to say a quick thank you to my newest supporters on Patreon, Sonia Bondarsev. Sonia, hope I didn't butcher your name too much. Jessica Cavalli, Catherine Thompson, and Susan Starling, who raised her pledge to my new $5 level. I appreciate all of you who continue to pledge your support. It demonstrates that you're enjoying the show and you want it to continue. That's more encouraging to me than you may know, so thank you. Listeners who support the show on Patreon can access a guided meditation called Messages from Your Spirit Guides, exclusive bonus episodes, and there's also a mastery level of support where you can download one of my courses for free each month. To find out how you can become a patron, support my time in producing this show, and access all the extra bonus content, please go to patreon.com/shiftyourspirits. Okay, I have to give credit to my friend Brandon Ellis for doing a lot of the legwork around my interview with John Shaughnessy. Last year in March of 2017, Brandon posted a written interview on Medium.com titled Why the Pyramids Were Really Created. I'll link to that, of course. And my immediate response upon reading it was, oh my God, this makes so much sense. I couldn't wait to tell my dad about it. I grew up watching Carl Sagan Cosmos documentaries with him, and I just had to tell someone, and he was the kind of person with the kind of intellect who would really be excited about this information. You know, like, I'm genuinely so excited about this and being able to share it here on this platform. I think I've mentioned before that Brandon's newsletter is often filled with all the cool research he does for his science fiction novels. And I kept saying, Brandon, why don't you come on the podcast and talk about all this ancient aliens lore that you're studying? And people would, you know, love to hear about this stuff. And he suggested very humbly that I go to the source of some of it anyway and talk to John Shaughnessy directly. So thank you to Brandon for the introduction to John and for requesting this episode. John Shaughnessy has solved why the global pyramids were built and how the moon powers them all. And here he is to tell us about it.
Well, I'm John Shaughnessy. I come from Massachusetts. I grew up in Massachusetts, a few miles outside of Boston, downtown Boston, in a small suburb. And I first got introduced into, say, like the space, generally, whatever you want to call it, the cosmos. And I got a part-time job working on the weekends at the Museum of Science. And in the Museum of Science, they have a place called the Planetarium. And I was, taking tickets. I'd sell tickets for the Planetarium show. And I just fell in love with it. I mean, we were doing special effects. I was involved with running around during the show and changing slides in the old Bell and Howard projectors. And, I had the place myself, like Saturday, Sunday mornings. I'd get in there early. I had the place myself and this big giant Zeiss projector. After I knew what I was doing, I was shutting the lights down and having my own light show. And that lasted about 2 years, but it sowed a seed in me. And later on, I've always had psychic anomalies that would just come in, and I would know stuff before it happened, to the point where I'd freak out my friends that I was hanging out with. But I just shrugged it off, make a joke out of it, and then because I didn't know what was actually happening. Back in the day, you didn't have a class in middle school on how to deal with your psychic personality, you know what I mean?
I still don't think they have that on the curriculum.
There's reasons for it, you know. It scares the hell out of people. Well, the ones that are in control anyhow. But that all being said, I joined the Navy. You know, it was my first geographical cure, and jumped into the service. And I was on a small ship, the USS Miller, and we did a couple of, major cruises. It was 3 6-month deployments. And one of them, it was like a small shakedown cruise. You're just going up and down the eastern seaboard, say, from Halifax to Puerto Rico and maybe down to, through the Bermuda Triangle. And one particular day in the Bermuda Triangle, I had an event, and that kind of shook me to the core. It was, we were a mighty ship, and it was a clear blue day, not a cloud in the sky, and the ocean was, the same color as the sky. Really, you couldn't tell where the horizon began and end, and we just lost power. This mighty ship with backup generators, battery, everything just went completely dark, still, quiet. There's no waves, just amazing. And it was about 10 minutes of just sitting there. And the eerie thing, it wasn't a lot of talking. It was like we were just looking into each other's eyes, when we could, because we had little battery lights that lit up so you could catch people's faces. And so you were it was like a show made up of mimes, we're just looking at each other. So what's going on? What's happening here? So it was pretty profound. And then after we, got the power back, generators finally kicked on, we got going. And, there was no real investigation that actually came down to the crew, right? I wasn't an officer. I was just an enlisted man. And, so it kind of triggered something in me, and I started chasing the paranormal, and I got one of my favorite books back then. I forget the author. It was The Probability of the Impossible. And, you know, it was like maybe hundreds of incidences where, you know, things that just defied logic and science. And so that just, I just got hooked into that. And, you know, the Bermuda Triangle, there was a lot of books back then, the Bermuda Triangle, and Eric Von Doniken's work. I grabbed a lot of, you know, Chariots of the Gods, and started reading a lot. And so I was always interested in the unknown, the mysteries. If somebody couldn't figure something out, I'd show up. But if everybody had it all figured out, it didn't interest me, you know. So if there's any puzzle or a conundrum, a car wasn't working right, or something like that, I kind of enjoyed solving those problems. That's just how my brain worked, and a lot of times it was would get intuitive, and you know, I'm the type of guy that can get from A to C without going to B, and a lot of areas of in my mind. And I have the mind where I can put things together inside my brain. I don't have to draw things. I can, you know, just build systems and troubleshoot without having to do the hard work on the bench, so to speak. I can, you know, walk it through and, well, that won't work, and, you know, and kind of works like that. And so I got into the power industry, and I'm retired right now. I got into generating electricity utility level, gas turbines, and you know, boilers, steam turbines, pretty large machines, you know, 100,000 horsepower. And I got into hydroelectric dam operations. I used to supervise. I was a supervisor in the big utilities, Con Edison, Northeast Utilities, and retired now. So that's good. So I can put more of my work into you know, my real passion, and that's you know, these leftover enigmas that seem to be sprinkled all over the planet. And one particular time, you know, I got into you know, I was, you know, getting into the pyramids. Like I touch topics, and I just dig deep into them. And, you know, I'd read all I could. And, you know, I just get obsessed with it. And I just hit a wall, you know, I just hit a block. I was fascinated with gravity early on. You know, I thought that was an awesome field to get into and try and unlock, and, you know, basically, you know, whatever, you get some kind of anti-gravity machines going. I did a lot of experiments. I was able to manipulate, you know, the weight of an object in an apothecary scale with, you know, rotating mass. And then, but, you know, what I found, as I got deeper and deeper into this, I would be reading, you know, Einstein's theory of special relativity, a lot of Tesla's work. So I was self-taught, really, just self-taught. Whatever I kind of got obsessed with, I just dug into it until I got to the bottom of it and got bored with it, or I just couldn't get any further. And one particular day I came into the living room, the TV was on, and Machio Aku is a pretty famous physicist out of New York. And he, you know, he was cutting right to a commercial. He kind of just, the last words he said as I was doing the, you know, the dead drop into the lazy boy was, "We still don't know what these pyramids are doing," you know. And then it just went off to a commercial, and I muted it, which I usually do. And so it just had an epiphany in my brain, you know, just the thought going, I wonder what's on the other side of Giza, you know, the Giza Plateau pyramids. I've always had globes around me. Like, if you came into my house, there was globes, there was atlases, there was, you know, and maps and things of that nature. So I was pretty up on geography. And like I said, you know, I got a little bit of training when I was 16 at the Museum of Science. So I was obsessed with, you know, how the universe worked. And I got up, I walked across the living room. The globe was a floor mount globe, about 4-3 feet high, and I found Giza, and I spun it 180 degrees, same latitude, not antipodal latitude, and my finger landed right on the Hawaiian Island chain, right? So, well, that's strange, you know. And, you know, just my background in gravity and you know, the high, the tidal lock with the moon and things that automatically kind of clicked in subconsciously, like this, the only real connection here is gravity is such a large distance. So therein lies the basis, the foundation of a theory that I've put out into the world with books, videos, talks, conferences, and so on and so forth. So as time went on, I got into, next couple of weeks, my brain was just set on fire. I was driving down the road, writing down notes. It's like you got this proverbial download of about 30,000 words in about 5 minutes. And you were like back engineering what you just took in, kind of type of thing. And because it was pretty profound, you know, the hair on the back stands up, your neck stands up, and you get the shivers, you know, you're onto something. So long story short, I started saying, well, if Giza lines up with the Hawaiian hotspot, what are the other pyramids doing? You know, so I got to, back out of this, my early theory of that there's a connection between the two, and say, well, if there's a connection between those two, it's got a connection to the other ones. And lo and behold, every time I went to a large cluster of pyramids, or large pyramids, 180 degrees and on the same latitude, there would be a volcano that aligned with it. So the Pyramid of the Sun down in Mexico would align with Mount Sigiriya in Sri Lanka, which is an ancient volcano. It has if you can believe it, an alien-shaped, elongated-shaped skull for a magma plug. And it's got huge claws at the base of it. Nobody knows where it came from, who built it or anything. And they rival the size of the Sphinx. So that's interesting. So, and then I went to, over to the Shen Pyramids, another large cluster of pyramids, and that aligned with the Bermuda Island, which unbeknownst to me at the time, it was made up of two ancient dormant super calderas that actually make up that island. So, and then, there's El Tigre lines up with the Andaman Islands. It's down in Guatemala. Now, those pyramids are twice as high as Giza, as at El Tigre, and the other name escapes me, but La Dante. So, I mean, these, I was like, okay, these pyramids are lining up with these volcanoes, a strip of volcanic islands or another island, and with a volcano. So after I got up to 20 and then 30 and then 40, I said, okay, all right, there's definitely a connection here. And I'm like, well, at the time, I didn't have it all figured out. I don't know if I have it all figured out now, but I'm pretty deep into the theory. I was like, okay, what's driving this? I mean, my mind at the time, I just felt like gravity was static on the Earth. My concept of gravity was static. It was static gravity, like, we have, we have a gravitational field, and it's X amount of meters per second. That's the force of it, After writing the book, I wrote my book, and then a lot of times you get what you get as much information as you have, and you have to get it out of you. You have to put it in writing, and so I put my first book out, Pyramid Gravity Force, and during that process of putting that all together. If you look at the cover of my book, it's the Earth, the Moon, and a pyramid, a large superimposed pyramid on the planet Earth. And I got a little one-line diagram that goes from the pyramid down to the core and back out to the Moon. So that's where the gravitational energy was coming from, that was actually connecting these spots together. Now, at this particular geological time frame that we're in right now, the Nile Valley pyramids are aligned with the Hawaiian hotspot, and that particular alignment is active right now. So that in and of itself is, I call the Hawaiian hotspot the magma relief valve of the planet in that particular location. It's the only constant erupting volcano because it's artificially controlled from the large pyramids on the other side of the planet. So basically we spin through the gravitational field of the moon, and that is the perpetual motion. This is a perpetual motion machine, energy machine. And you get the feedback from that energy when you go down to the ocean and see the tides roll in and roll out. I mean, this is a massive energy connection between this heavenly body we call the moon. And so that I said, okay, it is the engine, is the mechanics behind the system that basically lowers the gravitational field when the pyramids of the Giza Plateau spin through the moon's gravitational field. It lowers the gravitational field under the Hawaiian hotspot and allows that magma to dribble out. Now, granted, it's different alignments out there in the solar system, like we just went through. Not to get off topic, I got to watch out. I get so many thoughts in my head. We won't be coming back. I mean, this is a real weird alignment. Anyway, I'll just touch this. Hopefully, I can get back to where I was going, but.
I'll bring you back. I'll bring you back in a minute. I'll bring you back.
Well, I mean, this is we're at a solar minimum, and in conjunction with that, it's just, at the same time, we have all the planets on one side of the sun. You know, mm-hmm. So we have this huge draw of gravitational pull collectively by all the planets, and that's why, consequently, we have this a very hot summer that we just went through. On top of when the sun is at the solar minimum. It actually puts out more radiation. You know, it's actually hotter. I don't know. Most people probably can identify when we walk outside. It feels like somebody's jumping on your head.
Yep.
So, or pushing down on you. It's like somebody's deflecting your field. You know, it's like you're carrying a 50-pound backpack around everywhere
it's
you go.
It's making us feel a little crazy, right?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. So it's a lot of energy coming in, and most people probably, you know, intuitively we're just ducking from one shaded place to the next, so one air conditioning place to the next, just to stay out of it. But that all being said, getting back to the moon and the pyramid here, when we spin through the alignment of the pyramids, and we'll stick with the Giza Plateau. Everybody's mm-hmm. familiar with those. They're set up in the Orion configuration or a dogleg, and the smallest pyramid cuts into the moon's gravitational field because we spin into the moon's gravitational field, and then what this does this way they have it set up it. So if you can visualize the Earth spins into the moon's gravitational field. It sets up the Fibonacci vortex, okay, and then the other two larger pyramids, GP2 and GP1, follow suit and flow through it. Now that creates a huge gravitational vortex in that zone, and it goes, you know, through the planet and lowers the gravitational field on the Hawaiian hotspot and allows, you know, the magma to free flow and. So that all being said, that's kind of the mechanics of what's going on with Hawaiian hotspot and the Giza Plateau pyramids.
So it's controlling the Vulcan forces at work in the Earth, right? Like it's stabilizing something, right? Like what's the purpose here?
Well, if you step back. And, God built the planets, if you go back and, you go into the ancient texts, it was built by, higher minded, beings, God, mm-hmm. whatever you choose. And, you put a planet together like Earth, you're going to ask yourself, okay, what's my biggest one of my biggest challenges here. One of the biggest challenges on Earth is magma control, like controlling tectonic plate slips. Most of our volcanism, volcanic activity on the planet are, build up pressure, explode, kill everything for 100 miles around, and then seal back up again. Mm-hmm. So that all being said, there's, you got the Ring of Fire, which we have a consistent volcanic activity. And right in the middle of the Ring of Fire is the relief valve, the Hawaiian Hotspot. So essentially, when we do go into these alignments that I just alluded to this past summer, since April, we went in, all the planets are on one side of the solar system. When that happens, there's going back just 120 years, and you can go back, thousands of years now, but I mean, just the last 120 years, that actually happened like six times. And every time that happened, we had a 3,000% increase in volcanic activity on the planet. So stepping back, you're in a solar system, your planet's in a solar system, and it's affected by outside gravitational influences by the planets. And so you're the host planet for intelligent life. So you want to keep it calm. So what you do is you build some pyramids and you create this relief valve using the gravitational force of the moon, which is the biggest player of gravity on the planet. The other planets do increase and decrease that force, but nevertheless, the moon is the biggest gravitational force. So when these energies come into play on the planet and create magma pressure, and especially in an interglacial period, like right now we're in the warm-up period, so you're in expansion, the poles are rising, the plates are getting squished together around the equatorial region because of heavier ocean. So you get a lot of, we're going from pumpkin shape to spherical shape. So you're in a constant changing environment. So this tool, this mechanism, this engineering that's been on the planet for, eons, I think it comes and goes. These things have been proven to have been rebuilt before. These pyramid systems, they've been rebuilt. There's older ones underneath. As the technology comes back into the human consciousness and mainstream grabs it and says, oh, hey, these things are important, we better do something about this. So they're actually playing a critical role in our survival. And then that reemphasizes the rebuild and the physics and everything else that comes along with it. So sum that up, that's what this is. It's terraforming, and it's also I hate to use the word geoengineering, because it's got a bad rap lately, but it's geostabilizing. Okay, so in essence, when you get control over, if you saw that amount of magma coming out of the Hawaiian hotspot just recently because of the alignments of the planets and a solar minimum in piggybacking that alignment, we had a lot of magma. Now, if you didn't have the Hawaiian hotspot at a low gravitational field with the pyramids in the Nile Valley manipulating that and allow that magma just to flow out freely, and that, just say the Hawaiian hotspot just sealed up for a year or so, there'd have been a catastrophic explosion of beyond biblical proportions. Okay, we could have been going into the Stone Age a lot sooner. So, and what that also that particular location does, it lowers the magma, the lower mantle and upper mantle pressures, and allows it to bleed out. And it prevents like super calderas, like Yellowstone super caldera, from erupting. There's another giant super caldera in South America. So there's a reason behind the madness, or the magma. No pun intended. But there's a reason behind magma control. So that's what it's all about. I mean, that's kind of where I've pulled this all into some serious you know, scientific theory. And what backs up my gravitational theory is the moon and the high tide. Like, a lot of people aren't aware that on the moon side, you get the high tide. Well, on the moonless side, 180 degrees opposed to it, you get a high tide also. So I call that the moonless high tide. So you get the moonless high tide and a moon high tide. So therein lies the evidence, the physical, repeatable, observable evidence that this is how gravity works on the planet. And recently, like the last couple of weeks, Russian scientists released a study and got published. I think it was ITCO University. I forget the name of the university over in Russia. And they built the Giza GP1 Khufu's pyramid to a scale using the same material. And what they did was they submerged it in a bath of not a bath, but they submerged it with electromagnetic energy. And what they were able to find was the three chambers inside the pyramids, the King's Chamber, Queen's Chamber, and the subterranean chamber, actually were focal points. Okay, they were concentrating the energy inside these focal points. And then they did the same thing with non-ionizing radiation. We know it as radio waves or some form of radio wave. And they got the same result. They published the result. And it's in my book, you know, that the different language, but the pyramids are subatomic, you know, particle lenses. And I published videos on YouTube in my name on, you know, pyramids being lenses. And I've also put down, you know, the inner chambers were the focal points. You know, I've gone out and spoke about this. I got a Russian interview on, it's like their version of the History Channel, about 15 minutes. They were really great. They did a lot of great graphics, bringing my theories in about 4 years ago, 3 years ago, I think, or 3 or 4 years ago. And so I got on Russian TV and I got the expel on that. So somebody must have been listening over there and said, hey, maybe this guy's got something going, just theorizing. They're actually pretty advanced in, you know, their search for understanding what the pyramids do and what's it all about. So that all being said, that came back recently to me as, okay, proof positive. Your theory's right in a lot of aspects. They're actually coming back with physical, repeatable evidence that are being done in controlled labs. So the next step is getting whatever you want to call it, the industry, the mainstream, paranormal, new ages to look at these alignments. Say, you know, there's a connection between the pyramids and the volcanoes. These things are, you know, you're not putting 6 million tons of stone together to run a couple of light bulbs. You know, it's just, mm-hmm. you know, it's not. And I'm not putting down anybody, you know, that comes up with theories or what have you, because it's those theories that we all build our theories on, and we, you know, get higher and try to figure out what's going on. So
what is this? What's coming up? Like, what does this mean? You talked about the fact that this is controlling the ice ages, right? And so there's going to be a pole swap at some point, correct?
Well, I'm probably the only one out there that's not in the pole swap camp, but
okay.
But I'll tell you why. Getting into my science there, and looking at the planet and knowing how the subatomic particles flow, just like the astrophysics, the theoretical physics community, and all the muons, electrons, gravitons, fluons, croutons, whatever. I mean, you know, they all come in from the poles and they go out the equatorial region and they rotate back in, just like the magnetic flux lines or that's so famous, that image of the magnetic field on the planet that creates the Van Allen belts and so on and so forth. But what these plant, I call them plant builders, you know, what they've done is they've created a huge Antarctica continent is shaped like a hexagon, just like Jupiter and Saturn. So in effect, it's kind of ties into the tetrahedron, and so it's a tetrahedron. So in my book, that the tetrahedron, the shape of this particular continent, sets up to be a subatomic lens. It's like a giant pyramid. It concentrates the inflow of subatomic particles in the southern hemisphere, the South Pole. Now, if you look at the North Pole, there's nothing really up there. It's water, you know, ice water. There's no giant lens. So what you have to visualize is that you're going to have a higher flow coming into the North Pole and a slower flow coming into the South Pole because of the continent is right there, Antarctica. So what that does is slows down the subatomic flow, and that also slows down or blocks the flow to singularity. So you have a larger, say like a 70% of subatomic flow in the north and 30% in the south, but the flows actually are going at different velocities. So this is what locks in the magnetic field.
So this is maintaining the magnetic field and it's also ultimately like making the planet more habitable. Without it, it'd be too chaotic and volcanic for us to even be here, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's all part of a huge system. Like everywhere you go, every continent you go to. So like reinforcing my so that's why I'm like I'm a naysayer on the magnetic pole swap. One, because I know the people that built this planet, that did the last rebuild, terraforming, they're geniuses. Look at that, you know, they don't want to come back and rebuild pyramids every year. They do it and they make it last, and they see the human consciousness when it needs to be, and when we get to that level, so we can understand the technology and reutilize it and build it and rebuild it and things of that nature. So
let's talk about that for a second. So first of all, let me ask you, like, when you talk about the planet builders, are we talking, you know, Atlantis, Lemuria, ancient aliens kind of concept? Like, where do you come in that whole thing? Like, do you think somebody came here and set this all up for us?
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, so, well, tell me a little bit about that, because you're obviously a very science-minded guy, but then you also, you do mention Edgar Cayce, and you talked about how you were intuitive, you know, that you get these downloads, which was crazy, because this is the first time you and I have ever talked, but, you know, the people who listen to this show, that's something we talk about a lot. So when you say it's coming into the consciousness, talk to me about... Are you one of the people who's bringing this through currently? Like, do you see yourself as like, okay, I'm, you know, meant to bring this information in and put it back into human consciousness?
Yes. I feel with the trying to stay humble and keeping your ego in check. I feel that my information is radical. It's new. It's not mine. This stuff was already here. You know, like I'm just saying, hey, I think this is the way these things work. And this is the proof that I have. This is the physical evidence. So yes, I think it's part of the human consciousness. We get seeded at different ages in the human history. This last, you know, go from, you know, the ice age into the interglacial period, whereas I feel that is when humanity peaks at the peak of the interglacial period. Then we go into the ice age, and then, you know, we drop off and we forget everything, and we're, you know, only to come back and you know, do it again at the next interglacial period. But hopefully, you know, we won't be on the oil economy. I think we got sidetracked into this oil economy by some corrupt individuals. But anyways,
So yeah, so like our whole this is waves of rise and fall of human civilization, right? Okay.
Yeah, if I'll just make a point, like if Michael Cremo, I don't know if you know, he's done a lot of work and he's got a lot of evidence that modern man's been down here for a minimum of 500,000 years. There's evidence all over the place that supports this. And, you know, obviously it's buried because it goes up against the narrative, whatever the narrative is, and at any particular day. So it's just a rise and fall of humanity. Now, to come into this environment, you have to take the physical form of a human being, whether there's walk-ins or people just come into you or what have you, or you're just a real mature soul and you've ascended to a real high level of consciousness. Like you see, I mean, you got the Buddha, you know, Gandhi, just to throw out a bunch of, I mean, you have Martin Luther King, you have a lot of very mature souls, you know, Jesus Christ. I mean, going on and on and on. I'm just talking, you know, there's a lot of them. I'm not getting everybody, obviously. I don't want to offend anybody, but I'm just saying we get seated with these masters really of human consciousness, and in the middle of that we get people like Tesla, Einstein, Newton, Galileo, a lot of the Greek philosophers. You know, they come in and they pass a message along. They bring in ideas, technology, concepts, sciences, and things of that nature. So it's just a recirculation of the human consciousness on the planet, and it's like you know, the old proverbial saying that your soul is here to have a human experience, not the other way around, you know. So so I think it's a tool for growth for the spirit, if you believe in incarnation. You know, you're coming back, and hopefully, you know, every time you come back, you utilize that space and time to ascend to a higher state of consciousness. And, you know, then maybe, you know, eventually you don't have to come back and just sit up on the moon and watch the big show, I guess. I don't know.
So in your theory, the information that you're accessing is kind of held in the collective consciousness. You know, some people call it the Akashic records, or you know, there's some other dimension where this knowledge exists, and different ones of us tap into it. And you know, I actually think a lot more people tap into it than we even give credit for. You know, there are those ascended masters that are like the kind of rock stars, but then there's a bunch of us that do it a little bit here and there, right? Just humbly, you know, thinking of it that way.
It's a collective group. I wouldn't be where I was at, or you know, and maybe I'm supporting somebody I don't even know, and they're going to come up with something even, you know, that's going to add to it, and you know, like the Russian scientists just doing this research, and then you know, the time spans are amazing. I mean, you're only down here for a short amount of time, and all of a sudden, you know, you're starting to get this wave of science, you know, and it's all coming together collectively from different parts of the world. And from places you'd never expect, and it's it's like we're a very small pocket of humanity, people in this new age, truth seekers, I call us, you know, we're not satisfied with the story. We're lifting up the curtain, and you know, the Wizard of Oz, and going behind the curtain to see who's running the machine, you know. A small pocket, and we do add to the human family. We do add, you know, a consciousness that helps will help in the future, I think, to navigate us through you know, changes that are coming, and that's what I think it's all about. So
do you think there's something that we're supposed to do in particular, like? Do the pyramids need to be refurbished in some way? You know, do they need to be, you know, like maintained or something like that?
Right. I mean, yeah, there's, you know, I, you know, my mind's always going on about that. Like, you know, where are we at? What do we need to do? Are we at a critical stage right now? You know, 4 years ago, they came up with there's three times the amount of water trapped in the transition zone between the upper and middle mantle. And I'm thinking, well, you know, so that ties into the volcanism, that ties into mm-hmm. the magma control. And it's like this, you know, so there's I a lot of times I just get overwhelmed and have to just jump on the couch and take a nap. I just
do you think we're in danger of like breaking something?
I think it we're going up fast. The only thing I can say, you know, and what, you know, to sum up where I'm at, you know, the science and everything, and I go back to the ice core samples. Thank God for the ice core samples, because we can get some grounded. We can ground our thoughts on this particular source of time, right? And it goes back a million some odd years, but they've done a great job showing interglacial periods and ice ages, and for the most part, it's like clockwork. It's like 100,000, 104,000 years ice age, 13.5 on average for the interglacial period. So that all being said, all the ice is not going to melt in an interglacial period. If that ice is a million years old, we just came out of the ice age 13,500 years ago. Something big is, you know, a lot of people, oh, we're just going to wait for the ice to melt, but my theory in my other book, there is something about the moon, gets into the physics of what controls the ice age. And that is, as the ocean rises, the gravitation, this is common knowledge here, you know, that the moon's gravitational field is shifting from the glaciers and the polar caps, the actual claw. There's actually five images on the moon, and that tells a whole story also. But so it transfers to the hard surface of the ice, to the girth of the ocean. And what that does is it in effect is causing the Earth to tilt from 23.5 or 23.4 to, it's going to get down to 19.4 in Tiwanaku, the gate of the sun, the name escapes me now, but that's 4 degrees off. Now the gate of the sun, where the sun is supposed to rise up in the middle of it, and it will once we get back to the ice age tilt. Now the ice age tilt goes from 23.5 to 19.4 degrees, and then the sun will rise up in that gate in Tiwanaku. I think it's in Tiwanaku, but anyway, long story short, there's a highway in Mexico, and they've been marking the summer solstice sun at high noon, and it's been traveling 100 feet north south. Let me back. I'm stepping on my words here. So they're actually marking it, and they're marking the tilt. They're acknowledging the tilt is changing. So we are going to a lower tilt. Now, I mean, you got to go like 1,000 miles to get 1 degree. I mean, it's a pretty significant move. We don't think it is, you know, 19, you wouldn't think it'd be that big, but it's actually a significant drop, a significant movement in the sun actually coming up over the Tropic of Cancer in the summer solstice. And then you get the summer solstice in the southern hemisphere. So what's going on is that the solstices are squeezing the tropics. The Tropic of Cancer and Capricorn will move to 19. And what that does is lowers the light on the upper latitudes, both in the north and southern hemisphere. And essentially, we'll go into ice building mode. Okay, so this is the control mechanism that the moon also ties. It's a multifaceted engineering system that protects the planet. So if we're melting faster because of human activity, which we probably are because of the higher greenhouse gases that they surmise based on the previous ice core samples, we are way off the charts. So we're going to accelerate the melting of the ice, and it's going to hit what I call as the high water mark. And I think maybe Man Padol out in the Pacific might be the high water mark island. You know, it's only 5 feet high. I mean, 5 feet's a lot of water, but it is, as the water increases in volume in the earth, you're going to get more of a larger degree tilt in a period of time. So instead of 100 feet a year, you could be getting like a quarter of a mile. At some point, it's going to really pick up pretty quick. And that'll usher in the ice age. But this is a good thing, because we're in an environment where you can't flatline, because there's so much energy. The sun, Milky Way galaxy, the planets, it's either going up or down. And that's just the nature of the beast that we're here. And hopefully we attain a high level of technology that operates on the natural energy that the planet makes, besides burning stuff. We're in the burn and scorch technology. So
yeah, it does seem like there's probably some better stuff we could be using. My mind is like spinning out as you're talking. I'm thinking about maybe I'm getting downloads too, but I'm seeing all these potential explanations for what we call astrology. I'm seeing, how a lot of this ancient architecture that we have, like the hinges and all this stuff, that the Aztecs left behind, they really are some kind of calendars or possible, like you were talking about, they're marking this stuff on a highway, but that's like the really, scratching on the chalkboard version of something that has been left behind for us, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a book out by Derek Cunningham, and he surmised that the Sacsayhuaman, the sawtooth walls up there, and I did the same thing. I mean, we're different theories, but he's kind of said there was a language being, it was actually a language. Those shapes of blocks are actually a language.
Interesting.
Again, it's like a lot of these little tiny pockets of information. These people come in, they do the download, and they're gone, and so it's up to the next generation to come in and pick up and keep putting this together. But I think it's all instrumentation. That whole plateau up there is literally instrumentation of where we are in the ice age or interglacial period. And, you could actually measure the degree of tilt on a lot of these obelisks. You have three big, power centers. You got the Vatican, Washington, and some other place that escapes my mind that has these obelisks, and they actually measure the tilt. I mean, that's what those giant obelisks do. You can keep an eye on the earth, measure what's going on. There's a huge one in St. Peter's Square, which I've been before. So that all being said, there's instrumentation all over the place. You got Stonehenge, you got the pyramids, you got the temples. The temples are haven't completely been transcribed. There's there's information on the moon. The images on the moon also tell a story. Of where we are in the interglacial period. There's a famous stele with Akhenaten and Nefertiti. They're with their three children. Mm-hmm. And then in the middle they have, a disc, and they have the lines coming down. And at the end of every one of those lines is the same iconography of the moon, the claw, right? So you have this claw coming down. And you go through, this is actually a very short period in the span of time between the ages. You actually you spend a this is actually just a very rare point in time on Earth. The interglacial period is a very short span of time. The normal weather pattern is an ice age on the planet. You're 100,000 years building ice, and it's habitable. Humanity survives it, and life does flourish, but obviously not, you know, a mile under, you know, a glacier. But that all being said, that there's the a lot of the, as far as I'm concerned, a lot of the hieroglyphs and steles and images in Egypt, because Egypt seems to have like a huge amount of information on the moon and Mars and a few things, past life on the planet. So essentially that stele, that round circle in the middle, is the moon. Okay, and we rock back and forth, and as you can read the moon as it comes up out of the ocean or out of the horizon with the naked eye. Any higher than that, you have to get binoculars, but because you have a lensing effect when it comes up out of the ocean. But that tells you where you are in time on the. There's two clocks. You got the moon clock, which I bring in through with my co-author researcher Wendy Salter. We kind of put this whole thing together. On what the moon is, and then you have, you know, so there's a way of reading where you are in the interglacial period and the ice ages, just to sum that up. Now, the other big clock is the wobble of the Earth, where, you know, it's 26,000-year-old clock, and that approximately is a little less than that, but that actually is the only time we really have besides the moon. Like, if we didn't have the wobble, we wouldn't really have any real time clock, because we're just in a Milky Way band, just flowing around the center of the Milky Way galaxy, and all the stars remain the same. If you didn't have that wobble, like, you wouldn't have the change the zodiac houses, where the sun rises up in the zodiac house. We're in Pisces right now, and we're going into Aquarius, and so that those are two giant clocks. So it's like the wobble was made on purpose, like, to give us time. So mm-hmm. Like, every time I get, for me, every time I get into, like, you know, why I get, you know, why is that like that? Why is, you know, and it comes back with an answer. And that's the answer I got for the wobble. It's not like a defect, or it's not like everything is perfect on this planet. The solar system is absolute perfection at the highest level of knowledge, universal knowledge. So,
wow. Okay. So, yeah. Just to sum up for everyone, because again, we're just scratching the subject here, and possibly starting like 10 different conversations that I could go around. So
take it easy on the listeners, you know.
You've got to, and I'm going to link to all these things in the show notes for everyone, but just to break it down so everyone knows where to go get more information. You've got a free YouTube video of a lecture that you gave. It's a pretty good length. The main book we're talking about here is called Pyramid Gravity Force: How the Earth's Pyramids Work. And then you co-authored with Wendy Salter a book called There Is Something About the Moon. What are you working on next?
Well, I'm just the last couple of weeks, I brought in some discoveries on what controls the solar minimum, you know, and the irony here is like, the orbit of Jupiter is 11 years. The solar minimum is 11 years. It's like, hello, is anybody paying attention? Right. Wow. So even though the Earth rotates past Jupiter 11 times, it only comes in direct alignment between Jupiter and the sun just one of those, the last 11 years, you know, right before the solar minimum. So it comes into a direct alignment between the sun and Jupiter, and so basically I put a paper out, you know, put a video out, and I do try to get my stuff published. I put stuff out and I send it to the journals, and hopefully it's, you know, someday they'll get it through. But the bottom line is that what a lot of people don't understand is Jupiter is not in orbit around the sun. They actually, it's like a binary orbit between these two bodies. Like, they actually wobble on each other's axes, and or elliptic orbits rather. And they kind of, you know, they bounce out and around each other. So Jupiter's movement actually creates the corkscrew orbit of the sun, and that also has an 11-year cycle on it also. But long story short, what happens when the Earth gets in between Jupiter and going full circle of going back to the point I wanted to make is once the Earth gets directly in line with Jupiter and the sun, it actually blocks the gravitational field and kind of filters it, lowers it. And that is the source of all the turbulence on the sun. You had the sun storms, the spots, the black spots, the big giant magnetic storms. Once the Earth comes in front of it, the sun just goes into this pure fusion environment. It's fusion or fission. I always get the two mixed up. But anyways, it just goes into a pure, bulb, you know, and there's no spots at all for about 2, 3, or 4 months, sometimes 6 months. It depends. So it actually shuts down all that turbulence. So once the Earth passes out, it's like 2 or 3 months later, the torque begins between these two giant heavenly bodies, and you get the massive storm. So that was a recent discovery that I just brought in, it's tough. It's tough. I'm not in academia, so I'm outside. But I think that's where you do the most work. I don't have any constraints. Nobody's telling me I can't say this, and I can say whatever I want. You know, I don't have tenure anywhere. You know, so this is like what's good for me, and I think it seeds the mainstream world of academia. It resonates out and they'll grab it and, put something together with it. But, I mean, we need to know these things. It's like we really need to get on top of what effects these planets are having on our environment, because we're in a critical stage with, we're pretty critical with the heat. I mean, there's a lot of environments that are changing yearly, rapidly, very fast. And prior to that, I put a system together to forecast volcanic activity a little tighter with the alignments with planets and the moon and the moon's metonic cycle. It's a huge influence on volcanic eruptions. So like right now, the volcanic eruption prediction system we have right now, USGS, I mean, every country that has a volcano has some kind of prediction. And basically it's like, okay, if it's rumbling, they put a warning out to the local people, societies that are living at the foothills of these volcanoes. At Guatemala, we lost a lot of people just this past summer. And they put the warnings out to them, and the people there are saying, "Well, you know, it's been rumbling the last 10 years; nothing happened." But what I'm trying to get someone to help me build a software, because all this information is available. But what you can do is you can go back the last time a volcano erupted, and you can timestamp it and go back and say, "Okay, you get the timestamp on the last time that erupted," and you go back to a solar simulator. And find out where the positions of the planets were, and then also go back to the moon's metonic cycle. And what it is what, and this is what I've done, is I've gone back and looked at where that eruption was, and I went back and saw that they were in the same alignment that it was like 400 years ago. I'm just throwing, I don't know the date off top. I'm just to make a point. And so what this does is you can go to these people and say, "Hey, look, yeah, we know it's been rumbling the last 20 years, 100 years, nothing's ever happened. But the last time it did erupt, the planetary alignments were in this position, and the moon was in this particular part of the metonic cycle. And so you have more concern. So you're coming in with a little bit more heavier warning. Then you should get out of here, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's tough for people to pick up and just take off. I mean, their whole lives around these volcanoes. So that's kind of what I'm working on. I'm working on, that type of thing. And then I'm working on this, I'm working in on tying in this new ocean system into my volcanic theory that's in the three times the oceans are locked up in this material called ringwoodite, And it's a blue crystal type looking thing, but it actually has a high percentage of water in it. And it's equivalent, I the numbers are wild. I mean, but one of the numbers was three times the equivalent of the surface ocean volume is trapped in this line. Hmm. So I'm working on trying to figure out, like, is this something we need to be concerned with? Because it's a huge amount of water. And my thing is seeing that all the ice doesn't melt, because we know that, because, you know, going back a million years and we've had 10 ice ages with this ice that doesn't melt. And then you have the biblical flood stories from every ancient text. And I'm thinking, well, this water that's trapped in the that section of the planet, is this something that somehow ruptures and bleeds out to the surface for 40 days and 40 nights and then goes back down? You know, you're following.
Wow. Yeah. Oh my God, John, this is all so truly, truly fascinating, and we're just like scratching the surface here. I want everyone to go and check you out so that they can see the amount of research and detail there is behind all these stories and theories. Tell us where we can go to find you online.
I'm on Facebook under my name, John Shaughnessy, and my websites are pyramidgravityforceforward.com and tsatmoon.com, which is abbreviation for There Is Something About the Moon. And you can go there too, and that'll link you up. Both my books you can get on Amazon, Kindle, or Lulu Books. And you can get my emails also. I'm available. The email links or contact links are on those two sites. I have like 62 videos on YouTube. And I'm pretty much out there.
Okay.
If you Google John Shaughnessy, just throw Pyramid of Moon behind it, because there's a lot of John Shaughnessy. I guess we have a reputation of breeding like bread. So there's thousands of them. So you want to get the right guy, put Pyramid of Moon in, you'll get me.
I'll be sure and put like all those links that you just mentioned, make them really easy for people just to click on. John Shaughnessy, thank you so much for taking some time this morning to talk to me.
All right. Really appreciate you having me on there, Slade. Thanks again. Maybe we'll do it again soon.
Thanks again for listening to the Shift Your Spirits podcast. For show notes, links, transcripts, and all the past episodes, please visit shiftyourspirits.com. You can subscribe in iTunes, Stitcher, Overcast, or whatever app you use to access podcasts. If you'd like to get an intuitive reading with me or download a free ebook and meditation to help you connect with your guides, please go to sladeroberson.com. And if you're interested in my professional intuitive training program, you can start the course for free by downloading the attunement at automaticintuition.com. Before I go, I promise to leave you a message, an answer to a question or a concern you may have. So take a moment to think about that. Hold it in your mind or speak it out loud. I'll pause for just a few seconds right now. What burdens are you carrying around that you know you need to put down? What interior voices are you listening to that aren't even your own? If you keep working with the same programming, the same buggy code, not a lot is going to change. The good news is a lot of the internal stuff that's holding you back can be gotten rid of. And the first step, which you can do immediately, is to start naming them for what they are. Start identifying those voices. Start calling them out. When you catch yourself thinking one of those negative, limiting thoughts, say, hold on a minute. Stop right there. You're not me. You're not mine. And your time here is limited. Tell it to shut up. And I'll talk to you later.